Albert Woodfox versus Burl Kane. A lot of people here to observe and to educate us as well. We'll hear from Mr. Stanley.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. Rick Stanley here for Attorney General Caldwell and Warden Kane. We are here today to ask this court to reverse the district court's ruling granting federal habeas relief to the appellee. We believe this is important for two reasons. First, to give AEDPA the full effect it was intended to have by Congress. And second, to prevent a gross miscarriage of justice in this particular case. A brief history, this case has been to this court before. 23-year-old Brent Miller was a prison guard at Angola. He was brutally murdered in 1972, 41 years ago. Woodfox and others were indicted for his murder in 1972 and convicted in 1973. That conviction was vacated in state post-conviction proceedings. Woodfox was then reindicted in 1993 and convicted again of Miller's murder in 1998. The issue before the court today is whether the foreperson of the 1993 grand jury was appointed as the result of systemic intentional racial discrimination in violation of the Equal Protection Clause. A few key facts are not in dispute. First, the 1993 grand jury foreperson was selected by a judge. She was a white female. Second, the other 11 members of that grand jury were selected randomly from the other eligible members of the veneer. Those other eligible members included 5 black females, 3 white females, and 3 white males. In fact, Woodfox admitted in the state post-conviction proceedings that the grand jury itself was racially well represented. At least 9 grand jurors in Louisiana must vote to return the indictment. So there is no doubt that the 1993 indictment was returned by a racially diverse and gender diverse grand jury.
Talking about what is not disputed, is it disputed whether there would have been statistics on eligible grand jurors in at the time of the first presentation of this data, which was prior to 2000 anyway? Was West Feliciana Parish keeping lists of eligible grand jurors or numbers?
West Feliciana was keeping, I think, lists of the voter registration and from which the eligible grand jurors could have been picked. Whether you're asking was there eligibility, the answer yes, because that evidence was available, we believe, at the time of the direct appeal in the first.
That was June 23 of 2000.
That's correct.
All right, I'll be clear.
That's correct. And in fact, I think.
Prior to that time, and during the course of that appeal, all that data that you just described was public record.
I believe that. Yes, and I believe that that is made clear in the state post-conviction holding by the district court when it reviewed that, said that this data could have been brought forward in connection with the original proceeding.
Well, what about the statement in one of the briefs, some official for the parish said we did not keep that data? Is that not a reference that you're familiar with?
I'm not familiar with that reference, Judge, but it was apparent that the data was available, and in fact, I think there was a recitation that the commissioners were helpful in bringing that data forward when it was requested. So clearly, by virtue of the fact that Woodfox, in this case, was able to reconstruct the racial composition of 277 of the 297 eligible grand jurors.
Those are actual serving grand jurors.
Serving right? Grand jurors, as opposed to the eligible veneer. But the lists from which all of the evidence here was constructed in the district court was certainly available to all the parties at the time. And there's no evidence that I know of to the contrary. The first legal question before this court is whether the district court should have reached the merits of the claim. If this claim was reached and resolved by the state courts, then federal habeas relief is barred unless, according to the Supreme Court, there is no possibility that fair-minded jurists could disagree that the state court's decision conflicts with Supreme Court precedent. In other words, it is not enough if the state court was incorrect. It must be both incorrect and unreasonable. Here, the Court of Appeals for the First Circuit rejected the four-person claim because of failure in proof. And the Court of Appeals for the Louisiana First Circuit made it very clear that we know the number, or at least they thought they knew the number, of black grand jury four persons who were serving for the relevant time period, which was a little bit different than the one in the federal case.
So the Supreme Court upheld the First Circuit's ruling with simply a deny.
Correct.
Okay.
Woodfox's argument to the First Circuit Court of Appeal on the direct appeal was that that ought to be compared against the general population of registered voters. The state's argument was that the population should be considered eligible to serve.
Make sure I understand. You're talking about at the time of the First Circuit's ruling? That's the argument you're talking about? Or are you
That's
talking
correct.
About now?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
The argument to the First Circuit.
Right. In June of 2000. Or at least that led up to the June of 2000 decision.
Well, the decision came down on June the 23rd, I believe.
That's correct.
So
those were the two positions.
But the state, and I'm be clear, the state was arguing, and the First Circuit, of course, ultimately said they wanted eligible population statistics, but that was essentially the state argument that was made to them.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. And, in fact, the First Circuit Court of Appeal said that we noted disparity, but first, we don't think that necessarily that disparity is enough to raise a concern. But second, had you used the eligible to serve population, it may have disappeared. We don't know.
Was there any suggestion made to the court at the time of regarding the availability of the statistical base that the First Circuit thought the more out?
To my knowledge at that time, I don't recall anything being made to the First Circuit in that June of 2000 argument about
either way,
that. Either way.
Not available or not.
No,
sir. It wasn't done. It wasn't used.
Correct. Okay. Now, in connection with the First Circuit's decision, which was essentially saying that there's a failure of proof here, there's a failure of proof, you should have brought us the eligible to serve information. Can that be construed to be an unreasonable application of federal precedent as it existed? And I submit absolutely not. This court en banc in Barksdale versus Blackburn held that Castaneda should not be read to require the use of general population figures to measure disparities. So in Barksdale in 1981.
Let me ask a question. Is the First Circuit opinion that we're talking about now the last reasoned decision of the state court on the merits or not?
I believe it is.
Okay.
There is a state post-conviction from 2004
right.
that looks back to the direct appeal. And this court also in Roberts versus Thaler, 681 F3rd 591, a 2012 decision, this court looked back through a state post-conviction proceeding in Texas.
Okay, well, let's move for a moment to you had the state post-conviction. Louisiana Supreme Court has said denied to the First Circuit's decision, and then we turn to the state post-conviction trial level, which, as I understand it, the grand jury foreman discrimination claim was rejected that claim. And Woodfox there presented eligible population stats, correct?
He presented at that time, I believe, yes, a broader swath of evidence than he had on the first occasion.
Okay. Now, looking for the moment, focusing for a moment on what the ruling of that trial-level post-conviction court was, the court said, one, if he finds the allegations are without merit, right?
Yes.
And the written reasons were it failed to carry its burden. Right. So far, that's just a reaffirmation of the state's position.
That would be correct.
Now, but then the court says, it also adopts the state's brief. And your brief said that the grand jury claim should be denied because it had already been litigated, and I don't know what it said about the eligible population stats, but in any event, your position was in part to the court, trial court. Wait a minute, this has already been tried and resolved on direct appeal.
Yes, sir.
Okay. The Louisiana Code provision, 9034, it makes explicit provision for that prior determination.
Yes, sir.
But the court made no reference to that.
It did not.
Did the state argue it to it?
I'd have to look to the record for that. I can't tell you one way or the other.
Okay.
But that code provision does permit the district court to do what it did.
Well, what I'm zeroing in on is the question of what's the last reasoned decision on the merits query. Is this state post-trial decision a decision on the merits, or is it really a state court ruling that we're not going to entertain this claim because under state law, because you've already been answered on state law?
I had the same difficulty reading through it, Judge. I really believe that the state court, district court decision, the second one, is more in the nature of a procedural default argument, mm-hmm. that this issue was raised and litigated on direct appeal. I'm looking at it now, and the state court specifically refers to the fact that the defendant listed this as an assignment of error number 19 in his appeal, and then goes on to discuss the issue there. I think that it's difficult to understand from that decision whether it was purely a procedural default or whether they were reaffirming on the merits. But I don't think there's any prohibition under AEDPA or under this court's decision in Roberts v. Thaler that you can look through to the direct appeal to see whether the state courts reached this on the merits. And in this case, I think clearly they did and clearly they rejected it. And as I was saying, I don't think it's an unreasonable rejection based on Barksdale and Brummett. Quickly getting to the second point, even if we were to say that the district court should have entertained this and started to look at statistical evidence itself and decided whether or not there was sufficient rebuttal, I wish to make 2 points about that. First, the statistics here are either, as Woodfox contends, 2.37 standard deviations, or as we contend, 1.95 standard deviations. This court, Judge G, back in Boykins v. Maggio, said you don't even look to see if there's any problem unless you get greater than 2 or 3. So we're on what we would call the razor-thin edge of statistics, even if you accept Woodfox's argument. And Barksdale said, well, that's easy to rebut, except the district court stretched to credit the statistical evidence, but then stretched the other way to discount the state's evidence. The state put on much evidence of the fact that these judges considered non-racial factors in selecting as they were required to do by law. And, of course, that system has changed. And since 1999, grand jury forepersons now are done randomly. But at this time, they had to be selected by the court. And these judges worked hard to look at race-neutral factors, education, employment, leadership, and to be inclusive of protected groups, including women, because that's another thing the judges had to worry about. The district court, I think, tellingly, never found that these judges intentionally discriminated. They only found a failure to rebut. But the essence of the district court's reasoning was that the district court found no forms or questionnaires to support that the district court judge knew what they were talking about for those non-racial factors. However, on the same page, the district court said, it is correct to say that West Feliciana is a small rural parish where everyone knows everyone else. And indeed, that was the testimony of Judge Klein, that everybody did know everyone. So the fact that they had this information, this objective information, and were trying to be inclusive, is not fail in proof simply because there are no forms or questionnaires that could be produced. In fact, what Judge Brady did was introduce, 20 years later, a new invisible equal protection standard that these judges couldn't have met because they didn't know about it, that they would have to keep some record of exactly what factors they were considering in appointing their grand jury forepersons. I submit to you that the evidence, even if you get to it, statistically is razor thin, and on rebuttal, was more than sufficient under the Perez standards. I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Corrine Williams for Petitioner Woodfox. Before I start my presentation, I just want to respond directly to some of the court's questions with respect to the post-conviction court's decision. The state's brief before the post-conviction court did not expressly mention 903.4. The state's brief said that the evidence should be rejected, expressly used the word, the state's brief uses the word because it's meritless, and says that the information is identical to or the same as what was presented below. Beyond that,
what court are you, was this brief addressed?
This first brief was addressed to the post-conviction court. This is the state's
post-court.
Yes.
That has the decision that adopts the
exactly
brief.
So when the district court adopts that brief after finding,
let's stop. Be very clear about the. It's confusing about these courts.
Right.
This
That's
is a state trial post-conviction.
Exactly.
Okay.
So when that judge, calls it meritless, says Albert Woodfox failed to carry his burden, and adopts the state's post-conviction brief, that is the reasoning that that judge is adopting, reasoning which did not expressly cite to 903.4. Beyond that, we know
go ahead. Let me press you a little bit on that point, the consequence of that, accepting your argument for the moment, of your observation about what happened. You've maintained that then it's unclear that this rested on anything other than a merit, that this was arguably a merit decision, not a decision based on an independent state law or whatever. But what does that do for you in terms of AEDPA deference?
Well, I think what is clear about this post-conviction court decision is that it is contrary to an unreasonable application of law, and it's the last reasoned decision. It must be, because the very evidence that the state was faulting Albert Woodfox for below was presented to the post-conviction court. It was passed on by the post-conviction court.
I'm sorry,
it was presented to the post-conviction court. It was not barred. No one moved to exclude it. And beyond that, we know that before the post-conviction court ruled, the court gave a summary denial of Mr. Woodfox's claims, and the First Circuit reviewed it and said that Mr. Woodfox had made a claim which, if established, would prevail. So if there was a procedural bar to the claim, the First Circuit would not have remanded for consideration on the merits.
I don't want to collapse the into one inquiry, independent state ground basis, which would be just a state court ruling not reviewable by us, into a review by us of the decision by the metric of AEDPA. In other words, if I accept your argument so far, we still have the question of whether or not a reasonable jurist could have concluded that.
Right.
And given the uncertainties and the statistical array and the presentation of these cases, how can we say that is unreasonable? Now, AEDPA docks a large measure of deference. We know that. The courts made that, high courts made that very clear to us. Like it, not, agree with it, not, doesn't matter. That's the law. It's one thing to say that they're wrong about the stat and the use of the stat, but when you get the statistical measures and this type of evidence, they're not simple, and they don't lend themselves to a quick mechanical numerical answer. So what is your argument that this is so clearly wrong as that no reasonable jurist could have so concluded? To me, that's where we are in this case.
Your Honor, what was before the post-conviction court was an absolute disparity that was over 30%. The prima facie case presented at that stage had a looking at the range from 1963 to 1993. There was a 12% appointment of African American. I'm sorry, I'm a low talker. There's a 12% appointment of of African American forepersons and a 44% total population. There's ample precedent from the Supreme Court that absolute disparities over 10% are sufficient to create a prima facie case. So that's the, clearly established Supreme Court law. Beyond that, even in this circuit, Mosley versus Drecke, it makes clear that this circuit accepts absolute disparities over 10% as sufficient to state a prima facie case. So for the district, for the post-conviction court to reject Mr. Woodfox's claims on the merits, there is no conceivable reasonable basis for that to happen at the prima facie stage. The state had not presented any rebuttal argument at that point, so there was no fact-finding as to whether or not they carried their rebuttal burden. So I think it was clearly a contrary application of Rose Castaneda, and beyond that, directly went against every Supreme Court precedent that has considered what range of absolute disparity is sufficient to state a prima facie case.
So that takes you that into the review of the federal district court's Judge Brady's ruling.
That's right. And I would add, too, that even if you were to look through the post-conviction court to the First Circuit, as we discussed in our briefs at about page 28 to 30, the First Circuit was also clearly contrary to an unreasonable application of Supreme Court law. And this case suffers from many even ifs. Many of the state's arguments are unsupported by the record, but even if we were to credit them, although the district court below did not, and we should not, but even if we were to credit them, Mr. Woodfox should still prevail in this case, and the district court below should be affirmed. When you look at the 1993 impaneling of Mr. Woodfox's grand jury, what you see is that it was presided over by a judge who, in 17 years on the bench in West Feliciana, prior to the randomization of four-person appointments in 1999, selected a white four-person every year but one, including in March of 1993. When he had an opportunity to select a temporary four-person in March of 1993, he again selected a white four-person. This is an appointment pattern which, no matter how you test it, cannot fathomably be explained by chance. Using exact hypothesis testing, the one-sided p-value, or the possibility that we would see this appointment pattern as a result of randomness, is less than 0.5%. And that's using the state's baseline. It is greater, far greater than the commonly accepted confidence threshold. I'm sorry, far lower than the commonly accepted confidence threshold of 5%. So even if the argument that chance explained the systemic exclusion were to be credited, what we see when we drill down into the record in this case is that it does not explain what happened in Albert Woodfox's impaneling, with an appointment pattern of his impaneling judge being 1 out of 17.
And what is Woodcox's race? Is he Caucasian?
Mr. Woodfox is African-American. I'd like to turn and address a little bit more about the state's first rebuttal argument that, although I think even if you were to use the state's baseline, Woodfox should still prevail, there are myriad reasons why the district court was correct to find that this baseline was unreliable. Apart from the fact that the data was grossly incomplete, the data on which the state's expert relied.
Can I ask you a question about the role of a four-person under Louisiana law, grand jury? What distinct role do they? What roles do they play that's distinct from the members? They vote along with the members. But what else do they do that, other than just preside at the, I guess, at the deliberations?
Your Honor, I am not as familiar with Louisiana state law as some other attorneys, but I understand that under Louisiana state law, the four persons do have some additional duties with respect to subpoena power. I do recall that in West Feliciana, the four person had some unique duties with respect to touring, for example, the Angola prison that's in the parish because of some federal oversight. So there were some additional duties that four persons had. Of course, the Supreme Court in Campbell versus Louisiana made clear that it is not a ministerial function in Louisiana, in the Louisiana system, because of the fact that they are a full voting member and they were selected from the veneer. We know that when Judge Ramsher selected the foreperson in 1993, the veneer that he was looking at directly was 44% African American. It was a mirror of the demographics of the total population.
Would it matter if you constituted the full grand jury, and then you selected from that membership of the grand jury? The judge said, "Well, I'm going to ask Mr. Jones to act as foreperson." In other words, you qualify everyone, and they're the members of the grand jury, and then he just picks one. Does that matter?
Well, Your Honor, I think the Supreme Court has advised that that does matter. Then we would be in a Hobby situation where the Supreme Court found that that then there is a ministerial function for the foreperson. There's no sort of the influence of the taint of discrimination will not infect the entire grand jury because the grand jury was composed before the foreperson was selected.
So then you say that it is critical that the selection have been from the veneer and not from the constituted panel.
That's correct.
And this was the veneer.
That's correct.
And the veneer was flawed.
The veneer, we've not raised a claim challenging a flaw in the composition of the veneer. In fact, we know that the veneer.
The veneer that has got, if you have a veneer that is constituted with no racial discrimination, and the grand jury, including the foreperson, are drawn from that, we're down to just the question it's whether or not, in that circumstance, the foreperson of the grand jury selection is measured by the whether it matters. In other words, I guess what you're saying, if you had the veneer, then the judge picks a Caucasian every time from an otherwise qualified veneer, that would taint the grand jury itself.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Even though that function under Louisiana law is ministerial.
Well, again, I understand that there are some additional duties of a foreperson, but yes, but I think you are essentially, that is correct, Your Honor. And in this case, the judge, impaneling judge, did select a white foreperson on every occasion but one.
Well, I know I seem to be treading from a pretty settled area of the law. I know that, but what I'm getting to is the databases that are relevant in consideration of whether these choices are made properly.
Yes, and some of the questions that were directed earlier talked about sort of what was the available evidence at the time. And the database, the veneer, was composed from the voter registration lists. And Mr. Woodfox did present voter registration lists when he moved to Quash in 1995 and again in the First Circuit.
Okay, so let's go back to Judge Brady now and focus on Judge Brady and tell me exactly what he did with regard to the data. What were the flaws he found?
Well, Judge Brady did find that the state's baseline was more incomplete than the data offered.
What did he have before him? Did he reach, gather new, take new evidence? Or?
He did. In response to the state's rebuttal, Woodfox offered evidence of the seated non-four-person grand jurors and statistical testing, which showed that whether you used a one-tailed or two-tailed.
Does that raise a pinholster problem?
No, Your Honor. It doesn't raise a pinholster problem.
I assume it does not, but we need to know what argued it, but go ahead.
He also found, Judge Brady, that the state altered the numbers to reduce the eligible baseline population. The state focused myopically only on literacy. The judge did not reach this fact-finding, but we've argued, and the state has not disputed, that there is no evidence as to the validity of the underlying premises. The state's expert based his numbers on handwritten voter tables. We do not know which had indications for who was illiterate on the margin. We do not know how that literacy evaluation was conducted. We don't know if it was conducted. We might be in a situation like Pierre versus Louisiana where literacy was based on pure guesses.
When at the district court, you had a live hearing, not paper hearing. You, people testified.
That's correct.
Now you're describing a witness who testified before Judge Brady.
There was no witness who testified.
Well, that's what I'm asking you. Did you take live testimony?
We did. Oh, yes. We did take live testimony. The clerk for West Feliciana Parish testified that those voter tables were not her tables, that she didn't know how literacy was judged or evaluated, and the state otherwise presented no evidence to establish the underlying premises of that data. We don't know what literacy means, even for the, you know, 5 years of data that actually existed. As it stands, 6 years of the 14 years under consideration, the state's expert had to extrapolate and interpolate and create a regression model to estimate. In response, Woodfox presented the seated non-four-person grand jurors, unquestionably a qualified subset of the population. And Judge Brady found, as a matter of fact, that that data was more reliable and the appropriate baseline to use in testing the state's rebuttal argument that chance explained the disparity. When you use that baseline, it doesn't matter how you test it, chance can be scientifically excluded as an explanation of the disparity. I have just a little bit of time, so I want to address the state's second rebuttal argument, which is that race-neutral criteria that were used at the discretion of the judges explain the disparity. Again, even if you were to credit that as a general matter, I just want to make clear that there's a lot of inaccuracy there. There's not one whit of evidence in the record that the selection criteria used by Judge Klein, the only testifying judge, was the same selection criteria used by Judge Ramscher. Of the five African-American four persons in the prima facie period that were appointed, Judge Klein appointed four of them. So he was responsible for less of the discrimination in the parish.
What was Woodfox's evidence that he presented to Judge Brady?
In response to the to this?
You're now in the habeas hearing, and he's got to establish at least a prima facie case. But tell me exactly what he offered and was received into evidence.
In response to the state's rebuttal argument regarding discretionary, Woodfox offered transcripts of the grand jury proceedings, which show that.
I don't know. What did Woodcox offer in support of his prima facie case?
Oh, in support of his prima facie case, Woodfox offered evidence as to the total population, evidence as to the registered voter demographics of the registered voter population, as well as evidence of the seated non-four-person grand jurors. To demonstrate, as the prima facie case requires, the significant underrepresentation of black four-person appointments. That was at the prima facie case. In response to the state's rebuttal, Woodfox presented transcripts of grand jury proceedings which show that...
We have a binary from which the four persons to be selected, and the selection of which is not challenged, correct?
The selection of I don't understand the question, Your Honor.
I'm sorry. We have a, you said, as I understood you, that the evidence that you offered to Judge Brady was population figures, et cetera. My question, though, is that we have here a binary from which the disputed or challenged four-person was selected. That is itself unchallenged. So that suggests to me that the inquiry is over the to be discriminatory, impermissible discrimination. It's got to occur in the process of selecting that four person from an otherwise qualified binary. Correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Now, what was the data about that?
That primarily in this case, beyond the testimony offered by the state from Judge Klein as to his selection procedures, it was transcripts of the impanelings, which have verbatim record of what happened when the judge selected a four-person. And those transcripts show.
Where's the data, factual data, about that race is the consideration in the selection? And I thought you said earlier that you had information about how many four persons, the racial makeup of the selection Over a period of years.
I understand. And that was taken from the state courts, which information that the parties had stipulated to. In post-conviction court, there was a correction made because in the First Circuit, 2-4 persons were wrongly identified by the state as black when they were in fact white. So Woodfox did add some additional evidence at the prima facie stage, although the parties had already stipulated to that in post-conviction court, which proved beyond dispute that those 4 persons were white and not African American. So that's how the...
How many persons did you have that were selected that were white?
So there were 5 African American appointments out of 27 at the prima facie stage, so 22 were white.
27 grand juries selected and 5 were minority and the 22 were white?
Yes.
Okay. During the relevant time period here.
Right.
Yeah. I personally, a little bit, to keep your voice up, I find that the acoustics in this courtroom will go down each year, for some reason.
Well, I hope Your Honor heard me. And I see my time has expired. If there are no further questions, I rest.
Thank you.
Thanks.
A few points in rebuttal. First, Woodfox points this court to evidence that the district court absolutely did not consider. When they're talking about Judge Ramshur's only appointments, that would have been in stage 3 of the trial, which Judge Brady never got to, or at least never considered that evidence.
Explain to me what he did.
He essentially said, first show me the prima facie case based on statistics. Once you finish that, then I'm going to give the state an opportunity to rebut it. Okay. And then if they do, then I'm going to take evidence on this third stage, which no one quite understood. And he said that there was a failure in the second stage of the state to rebut.
Well, and the first stage, as you just described, I guess.
Statistical.
Yeah. And then you offered, what did you offer at that stage?
We offered in the statistics stage a proof of what the eligible population to serve would have been, using a statistician and
eligible
using...
population to serve of what, on the venire?
The grand jury venire, right. Because okay. In addition to simply being eligible to vote, which clears out some of the issues, one is the ability to read, write, and speak the English language, which is not accounted for just by being a voter. So using available information on literacy, our expert came up with a slightly different number of eligible population, 36% rather than 40.8%. So that was what was presented there. And I agree with Your Honor that essentially because the venire, there's no contention that the venire was improper. We're down to the intent of these judges. And there you'll look in vain for any finding by Judge Brady.
Stay with what... detailing what Judge Brady did. I'm unclear about that, and I
right.
suspect others are, too.
Well, what he did then was he looked at the state's rebuttal evidence, and he said, I've heard the testimony. It's not just Judge Klein. There's Judge Ware. There are other witnesses who testified about what these judges intended to do, and their attempts to be inclusive, because this is a difficult thing. We're almost using quotas under the Equal Protection Clause, which troubles me somewhat. But at any rate, he heard that evidence, and he essentially rejected it on the grounds that he found no forms or no questionnaires that would allow him to, in essence, corroborate the fact that these judges had the information about education and leadership.
What county? What parish is this?
West Feliciana. It's a rural parish, and the judge, in the same opinion, said, "I don't dispute that it's correct that everybody knows everybody." These judges had been there a long time, and they knew the people. So I think that there's no requirement that I know of for those forms of questionnaires. So stage 3 did occur, but the evidence that came in stage 3, according to the district court, played no part in its ruling.
I was not clear from the briefs. Why did stage 3 occur? Did the judge not make rulings until all 3 stages were over?
Essentially correct, yes.
Okay.
Yes. As to whether or not over 10% disparity means that you have to go down this road, some courts have, but other courts haven't. In the Boykins case, there was a greater than 10%.
Was there any finding by the district court supporting a finding of discrimination that addressed the fact that the decision maker himself, the credibility of the test of the.
No, I could not find that. And indeed, and I'm glad, it is important to remember that in order to sustain this claim, one has to find intentional discrimination. And that is, it's not simply enough to have the statistical evidence. That can give rise to an inference. But
Washington v. Davis settled that. That's not an issue.
Right.
That's what I'm getting at, is what is the, how, what.
You would have
your
to
argument was, as I understood it, that Judge Brady somewhat truncated the proceedings in some fashion or divided them and segmented them in ways that was hurtful to the state. I'm trying to understand what he did.
Correct, because the state wanted to put on evidence and did put on evidence in the third stage to demonstrate that if you either broaden the period or if you look at other evidence, for instance, about Judge Ramsher. Judge Ramsher did not testify. He was deceased by the time the federal habeas was filed. So there's no way to go back and get his testimony. But there was other testimony about how Judge Ramsher got elected, the people he knew in the community, the people that knew him in the community. All of that was stage three evidence, which really played no part in Judge Brady's decision.
How do we know that it played no part? He just said he wasn't going to consider it?
In his last decision, he said, I don't need to consider the stage three evidence because I find that from stage two there was no rebuttal of the statistical evidence, or that it wasn't sufficient to rebut because of no forms, no questionnaires.
What relief, if that was an error, what do you ask us to do?
Well, first, I'd ask this court, in terms of relief, I believe under AEDPA.
I know you said you had an argument.
But under the relief there, I think that this court reviews the record and reviews the fact that the case was proven under Perez and under Barksdale, where you have a razor-thin statistical case. It is not that difficult to rebut that statistical case, to rebut an inference of intentional discrimination. I believe on this record, the decision should be reversed. I'm out of time, and thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Thanks to each of you for your attention.